Up next, Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Tonight, we talk about lupus and how something called biomarkers impact its diagnosis and treatment.
More recently, new biomarkers have been developed that can not only predict the disease, but can predict flares of the disease.
Then, the latest on autism.
Initially, it was thought as bad parenting. If only the parents, you know, disciplined more, then that child would not be showing these behaviors. Rimlin actually, through his research, said, no, these kids are neurologically wired differently.
And we examine another health profession, the sonographer.
As the research continues, there's more applications that they are finding that ultrasound is more useful to diagnose and treat the high-risk pregnancies.
All that and our weekly visit from the Healing Muse coming up right after the news. This is Upstate Medical University's HealthLink on Air, your weekly dose of information about health and medical issues affecting Central New Yorkers from the region's only academic medical center. I'm your host, Linda Cohen. On tonight's show, an update on autism spectrum disorder. What's new, and does its incidence continue to be on the rise? And how modern-day sonography helps to shape medical care today. But first, how biomarkers can help to diagnose lupus. Systemic lupus erythematosus, or more commonly known as lupus, has nearly tripled in the last 50 years. And estimates indicate that currently there are at least 1.5 million Americans who have lupus. But is this a true increase or the results of improved early detection of mild disease? Well, here with some answers is Dr. Andres Pearl. He's the Division Chief of Rheumatology at Upstate Medical University. Welcome, Dr. Pearl. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you very much for having me.
So let's begin by explaining, what is lupus? What exactly is it?
So lupus is a systemic autoimmune disease, which is a prototypic autoimmune disease that can affect almost any organ of the body. It's a chronic disease with a waxing, waning presentation.
So people, sometimes you're more in, you have more intense
people can
symptoms.
Have flares.
Flares.
Usually people get flares 1 to 2 times a year. The average is 1.7. Flares can last for days to weeks, sometimes months, and people do not go into remission. These are the more severe cases. There are milder cases that do not flare every year, and the organ system involvement is much more limited. Fewer organs are involved. The survival of lupus right now is much better than it was 20 years ago. 20 years ago, about 50% died of lupus
really?
In 5 years. Today, the mortality is about 10% in 5 to 10 years.
So we've come a long way in treatment? Is that what's made the difference?
Yeah, the treatments have significantly improved, and the diagnostic workup has significantly improved. That helps with earlier treatment, also helps with diagnosing of the patient. So perhaps that explains why the increased incidence of the disease.
So then, in fact, it's a little bit skewed. It's not truly an increased incidence, but we're catching it earlier and being able to treat it earlier.
That's
and
right.
being more successful.
That's right.
Therefore, in the
That's
treatment.
Right.
So just you said it's a prototypic autoimmune disease. Help us understand what's happening in the body when we say autoimmune disease. What's going on?
Right. So the immune system is normally, we believe, is designed in a theological sense to protect us from infectious organisms. When the immune system encounters a bacterium or a virus which is foreign to us, we make antibodies, and our cells within the immune system produce compounds which destroy these organisms, like the T cells do that.
So the T cells, we were just talking about T cells on another show, and we were talking about them as almost the infantry in your army of your immune system, and they go out and they destroy
organisms or the cells infected by these organisms. Upon elimination of the antigen or infectious organism, the immune system should wind itself down. For example, if you have an upper respiratory infection, you can develop swollen lymph nodes, which often happens on some people have bad teeth. They develop a swollen lymph node, a gland, which in a few days this dissipates after the offending organism has been eliminated. You take antibiotics. In lupus, this doesn't happen.
So in other words, what happens, somehow the immune system gets revved up to attack an invader, but it never revs down?
That's right. So there is an inhibition of death programs within the immune system. That's a major genetic pathway that leads to lupus. Also, since I bring in genes, it's genetically determined, so it's inherited.
So it runs in families?
It runs in families, yes.
And is it literally generation to generation?
There are many genes involved. We have identified a number of them. The concordance rate in identical twins is 25%.
What translate that in
so
lay language?
So if you have an identical set of twins, there's a 25% chance for the second twin to develop lupus if the first one has it. That also implies that there's a lot of environmental factors that contribute to disease.
It's not 100%.
It's not 100, right?
So if you have a mother who's had lupus, does that mean all of her offspring would end up with lupus?
About 5%.
So it's not
about
right.
5% at most. But if there are identical twins, it's much higher.
But when you say about you, I interrupted you, I apologize, you're talking about environmental. So you're saying it is a combination of kind of nurture, nature. So you have the genetics and the environment. What environmental factors do you think play a role?
So among the environmental factors, for example, viruses and infectious organisms that rev up the immune system, which happens in everybody, can operate as triggers of the disease. It's believed that they operate as initial triggers and also triggers of flare.
So if you get a cold and you have the tendency to lupus, you might have that immune system gets revved up to fight the cold, but then it stays revved up. So help me, I mean, it's chronic, so it goes on for basically your entire life.
That's right.
When does it show itself? I mean, and who's most at risk?
That's a very good question. So the prevalence, which is the frequency that you encounter in the population, is about tenfold higher among females. And it becomes more prevalent with adolescence, with the appearance of the periods, menses, lupus starts to develop and
so
becomes more severe.
Endocrine, there's got to be some endocrine.
Estrogen, for example, plays an important role. When menopause occurs, about to develop, usually the flares become less severe and the disease tends to wind down.
So estrogen amplifies the whole experience.
Definitely does.
And I read somewhere that women of color also have
yes.
a higher incidence?
There's a much higher incidence in African-American females. Going back to the environment, an important trigger is UV light, ultraviolet light, which induces cell death and typically skin death, as you might imagine. People get sunburn, and that also activates the immune system. And in patients with lupus, the ability to downregulate this immune response to the damaged skin is also damaged. So that's
that
one trigger.
Does that mean that if you get a bad sunburn, you might get a flare?
That's exactly right.
Well, if you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with Dr. Andres Pearl, and we're talking about lupus. So what are the other complications of the disease? I mean, you say it can affect all parts of the body. Give me some examples of some things that happen.
So as I mentioned, lupus can be triggered by ultraviolet light, so people develop rash. The so-called butterfly rash is very typical. That affects the face. You can develop photosensitive rash on any part of the body. Arthritis is very common. About half of the patients develop arthritis of the small joints. That tends to be not as severe as rheumatoid arthritis, not deforming, but still very painful and debilitating. The inflammation can involve internal organs. Typically, the kidney is involved to a variable degree. The kidney damage used to be the number one cause of death until 20 years ago, when dialysis and preventative treatments have preserved the kidney in most patients. And now other organs are involved, the heart, the vasculature. The number one cause of death in lupus today is infection, due to the fact that we use immunosuppressants to downregulate the immune system.
So you have an an immune system that's out of control in lupus. So you use suppressants to downregulate that immune system, and then you leave the body open to other infections.
That's right. So that needs a lot of fine-tuning, what kind of immunosuppressants you use and what kind of antibiotics you employ with the slightest appearance of an infection, so it doesn't get out of control.
We talked earlier about the idea that it's possible that there's not a true increase, but that we're getting it earlier. So how are you currently diagnosing it? I know you've been doing work in what the field of biomarkers. Help us understand what that means and how does it help diagnose lupus?
So part of the diagnostic workup are laboratory tests. We have a number of laboratory tests which, if they are positive, they highly suggest lupus. These tests have been become part of the clinical workup perhaps 20 years ago or so, and they are still used. However, more recently, new biomarkers have been developed that can not only predict the disease, but can predict flares of the disease. These biomarkers, genetic changes, changes in gene expression, not only predict disease, but they also indicate what kind of genes could be targets for treatment. So these biomarkers now are increasingly used by the FDA to predict responsiveness to drugs. So
helping to develop new drugs, I would think, as well.
Help to develop new drugs, because the drugs would be specifically targeting these genes which are abnormally expressed. And once they are done regulated by the therapeutic intervention, you can predict that these would be effective. So you need fewer patients to do a clinical trial, so it would be cost effective. And you can also predict responsiveness to some type of treatment. Lupus is not a single disease.
Yeah, I was going to say, if it affects all those different organ systems, and even though at its core it's an autoimmune disease, I would think treatment would have to be multifaceted.
Right.
So what kind of treatment goes?
So when you use immunosuppressants, some of these immunosuppressants have side effects. So depending on the organ system involvement, you use one or the other. For example, if somebody has liver disease, you're not going to use an immunosuppressant that can damage the liver. Vice versa, if somebody has kidney disease, obviously you're not going to use an immunosuppressant that can damage the kidney.
So you're saying some of these drugs that immunosuppress, that suppress the immune system, have side effects that could damage the organ. So you have to really target the particular drug of choice,
right,
so to speak.
To protect the organ which is being damaged by the inflammation. Not only that you want to downregulate the immune system, but you don't want to do damage to the organ.
So this is very highly specialized treatment.
It is very highly specialized.
You really need to have basically a rheumatologist with experience with lupus, I would think.
I would certainly say so.
So what other things, as far as the blood tests that are done, your analysis, there's an ANA test, I guess, is looking for a certain antibody in the
blood.
And these biomarkers. What other tests are done?
We do clinical examination, which is also very important. Things are not overlooked, like rash, sometimes hidden some parts of the body. People don't get undressed sometimes when they see physicians, and certain types of rash don't get noticed. Or arthritis can be difficult to diagnose. The swollen joints sometimes are overlooked by fatigue, which could be prevalent, highly prevalent, and people forget to mention that I have stiff joints, for example, and the synovitis, which is inflammation of the joint, doesn't get recognized.
So it's a fairly comprehensive evaluation.
It is a comprehensive evaluation.
And you can be pretty sure if a number of these factors or features are there that you have diagnosed it successfully. But now it looks like the outlook is much more positive, given the fact that you said there's been such a reduction in mortality.
That is true.
And what's on the horizon for this disease?
So
we have a little bit of time.
Yeah, so the first biological was approved to treat lupus in 2011. This biological, when it was given to patients in a controlled clinical trial and compared to placebo, resulted in a 14% increased responsiveness, 14% more than the placebo. Seems like very little, right? 13% more patients responded to the drug than placebo.
Right.
So this was the first drug that was approved by the FDA in 60 years to treat lupus. That tells you it's really hard to treat, and it's hard to have one treatment that works for all patients across the board. So you need probably very specialized treatment for different groups of patients. So we ourselves are developing also treatments which are biomarker driven. and many other groups are doing that. So there are new drugs on the horizon.
So there are new drugs, and the goal is to use these biomarkers to target and figure out what particular drugs will be most sensitive to particular patients. Kind of targeted therapy.
Yeah, it's kind of personalized medicine, which you generally want to develop now, you know.
Similar to what's going on in the field of cancer today.
That's right.
Thank you so much. This has been very, very enlightening. Thank you very much for coming in and sharing this. And let's hope we'll continue on that quest to reduce the amount of mortality from lupus, especially with work that you're doing. My guest has been Dr. Andres Pearl. He's the Division Chief of Rheumatology at Upstate Medical University. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Up next, some updates on autism spectrum disorder. Is it still on the rise? You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. This is Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Linda Cohen along with you. Well, according to a report released by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention last year, currently 1 in 68 U.S. children has an autism spectrum disorder. That is a 30% increase from prior years. There is no known cause for the disease and no cure to date. Well, joining us to update us on the current status of autism in this country and what can be done to help these children are Dr. Carol Grant, director of the Margaret Williams Developmental Evaluation Center, which is part of Upstate Medical University, and Erin Kish. She's the vice president for a local autism advocacy group, and she has a 13-year-old son who has autism spectrum disorder. Welcome to you both. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for inviting us.
Thank you for having us.
So, Carol, let's begin with you. Help remind our listeners about autism. Give me what is autism, and then what is autism spectrum disorder?
Well, autism is a child who learns, or child individual learns differently. It's a neurobiological disorder, which means there's something different about how that child, that individual, is neurologically wired so that they take in information a little bit differently. They think about it, and sometimes that leads to behaviors that are a little bit different. And the behaviors that we look at are children or individuals involved tend to use language and communication a bit differently. They tend to not pick up on the typical social cues that you and I would. And often their interests and their play behaviors, if we're looking at a child, are different.
What are the kind of characteristic symptoms or characteristics that you often see with a child who is autistic?
Well, their eye contact is different, the nonverbal behavior. So, you know, as you know, if you're talking with somebody, you use your eyes and your gaze to communicate your interests or your not lack of interest or how you're feeling about the conversation. And if a child with autism tends not to use eye contact in a typical way, and they tend not to be able to read nonverbal cues. So you can have a little kid who can recite, passages out of the Disney movie, but when you ask him, do you want milk or juice, can't make that decision, can't use the words, and can't comprehend the words without some visuals.
So when we say autism spectrum disorder, which is what the original stats I was quoting,
right,
1 in 68 kids,
right.
How is that different? What does that mean?
Well, over time, again, this is a disorder that's only been identified since 1942. And initially, it was thought as bad parenting. If only the parents parented differently, loved the kid more, disciplined more, then that child would not be showing these behaviors. So it wasn't until 1942 that Rimland actually, through his research, said, no, these kids are neurologically wired differently. So we're on a journey that is still very young to figure out what is going on. So we have connected that it is not caused by bad parenting, but it is something the kid does differently. So,
but there's this new concept now is a larger definition.
Right. Okay.
There's a spectrum of behaviors that
right.
were no
in the very early stages of the diagnosis were not included. Am I correct?
Well, you know, it's very interesting. At the time that Connor, who identified autism, was picking up autism, there was a gentleman called Asperger's who was picking up Asperger's. However, World War II happened, and his information did not get translated. But anyways, the professionals have come to understand it more, recognizing that the core deficit in autism is social communication. It's the failure to understand normal social communication, how people relate to one another. And some people may be very involved, and some hardly at all. And if I can take a minute and talk about some very brilliant people who, again, are probably wired differently, but their difference has led them to make incredible discoveries.
Like who?
Well, my favorite one is the gentleman called, I think it was William Bentley, who discovered that every single snowflake is different. Now, this is turn of the century. He had primitive photography equipment. He had no electricity, so he had to spend his winters in a cold place to identify snowflakes. His work is now in the Smithsonian.
Well, so given the fact that we have a larger definition encompassing this, Aaron, is it that this so-called increase may not really be an increase in numbers, but the way we're diagnosing? Help us understand that. You have a son who is 13 now, who was diagnosed. Has the diagnosis changed, or the criteria for diagnosis changed a lot since your son was diagnosed?
I'm actually, because he was diagnosed so young or so long ago, I'm not sure exactly what the current criteria is. Carol probably can speak a little bit better about the actual, date versus date. But I know that because of all the awareness and all of the public being more recognizing of autism spectrum disorder, it definitely is being recognized more. And I think back when Luke was diagnosed, the only examples of autism we had were savants like Rain Man and things like that. So we didn't really have a whole... I knew nobody my whole life who had autism until my son was born. So
when did you first notice any issues or differences?
He was about two years old. 18 months to 2 years old is when he really started breaking away from his peers of the same age. His eye contact was almost non-existent. He wouldn't answer his name when I called him.
And up until that time, had he been doing that?
Up until that time, his development had been pretty dead on to what the textbooks tell you to look for as a parent. But then he just kind of started to break away. So I noticed those things. And the very first thing the pediatrician will tell you to do is go get his hearing checked. So we did that, and his hearing was fine. And then I had gotten the recommendation to seek out early intervention. So I had early intervention evaluate him, and he started getting services through early intervention at 2 years old for speech, because he wasn't speaking at all. No babbling, no mama, dada, there was absolutely no speech at all.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with Dr. Carol Grant and Aaron Kish. We're talking about autism today. So, Carol, the profile of these children today has changed. I mean, given the fact that we have a larger spectrum of children within this context, there seem to be more children with high IQs, that kind of thing, because at one time it was really thought to be in some way tied to developmental delay overall. And that's no longer the case?
Well, okay, so I've been studying autism since the mid-70s, and I think that our original thinking about children with autism was that we picked up the more involved kids, and the less involved kids, we perhaps misinterpreted them as being perhaps just odd, different, quirky. But viewed as oppositional, and because they often didn't comply with the social demands, and they were judged poorly. So I would say since the 80s, the professional world in places that have been studying autism have had their arms wrapped around it and understood that there's a full spectrum. So when you get to the question we often get asked, is there more children with autism or is we better? It's both. We are better at it. We are more comprehensive in looking, does that kid have that litmus test of poor social communication? But there's also more.
just a small sample, that back in the early 80s, there was one preschool program that had kids with autism. Now, every single preschool program has many kids with autism. There is definitely more kids with autism.
And we have no clue as to why. Well, there is this increase.
There's never been a more exciting time in trying to figure out the cause and the cure of autism, because, I mean, every day I see something new coming through my listserv of medical research. So, yes, we now know there's a huge genetic link. There's 5 times more boys diagnosed than girls. However, but if you have 2 identical twins, not both twins are equally affected, which says there's something environmental going on. For some kids, they are susceptible to some kind of environmental teratogen that is impacting the neural system. But there's definitely a genetic component.
Clearly, a strong one.
A strong one.
So, Erin, are children still being diagnosed late? I mean, I was reading something that the average age of diagnosis is still over the age of 4, which wasn't the case in your case. You were really kind of right on the money. What needs to be done in terms of the community's awareness or knowledge?
The difficulty, I believe, comes as a parent. As a parent, you give birth to a child and you expect that child to be absolutely perfect in every way, shape, and form. And it's almost a bit of a denial for a parent to accept, okay, I've got to face this issue and get my child diagnosed. And I talk to a lot of parents who just start out on the path and the adventure of autism or having an autistic child. And you go through, you have to face that denial and go through a little bit of a mourning period and kind of just face it. So that's the difficulty. Groups like Feet of CNY, the one that I belong to, we work with families like that, families that are just kind of starting out on the autism journey, all the way to families who have been in it a long time, and on the journey a long time, and fighting a really difficult battle with older children and older adults and things like that. We're all about families. So the greatest thing we can do as a community is really just put the awareness out there, make autistic individuals feel welcome in our community, make it so that the parents don't have to feel so much in denial.
Stigmatized.
Yeah, exactly. Stigmatized about accepting their child and the disability, because there's so much help out there with early intervention and programs like Carol's at the Margaret Williams Center and at Upstate to help. There's programs like FEET, CNYASA, lots of help out there in the community, so you don't have to have that alone feeling that you do when you initially admit that you have to have your child evaluated.
Yeah, it sounds to me like that first initial step is probably the most
difficult. Yes. Yes, it is.
And having support like this organization, this is FEAT.
Yes, Families for Effective Autism Treatment of CNY.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Really is an important resource, I would think.
Yes.
We can put a link to that on our website as well. Mm-hmm. Tell us what else is going on, Carol, in current treatment. We only have a few minutes left. Is something, are we doing any new things in terms of effectiveness?
The one bottom line research data that we have is that the way to alter the course is as Erin said, to get identified early so you can get early intervention and intense early intervention to hopefully help that child break through their lack of understanding normal communication and language and social, and help the parents, support the parents. Parents are big. They're living with the child. We need to help support them figure out how to engage with their child. And just one more point. There's many children are what we call late onset. So it is not atypical that a family that the child's development would look fairly normal up to 2, 2.5. And only at that point really start seeing the child literally lose skills and stop following the normal progression. So there is this, this whatever it is, developmental thing that some children are identified right at birth, but some are not until late, and that then delays, obviously, intervention.
Erin, what would you like parents to know in the very little bit of time we have left? What's the last thing, parting shot?
you're going to read a whole lot of stuff. You're going to see stuff on the internet. You're going to talk to a bunch of people, but you know your child best. That's the advice I give to every parent that I talk to. Follow your instinct, and you know your child best.
And seek help.
And seek help, absolutely.
There's a lot of support out there in the community.
Onondaga County is very rich in support.
Wonderful. Thank you so very much. My guests have been Dr. Carol Grant, director of the Margaret Williams Developmental Evaluation Center, which is part of Upstate Medical University, and Erin Kish, whose 13-year-old son does have autism spectrum disorder, and she also is the vice president of a local autism advocacy group. Thanks again, both of you, for coming in. I'm Linda Cohen. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. And now for some expert advice from the experts at Upstate. Dr. Bernadette Dunn, a clinical instructor of physical medicine and rehabilitation, will talk about what friends and family can do to be helpful to someone who is hospitalized after a stroke.
One of the most important things that friends and family that are very close to the patient and are going to be involved in some of the care of the patient at home can do for the patient is to come and attend some of the therapy sessions that the patient's involved in during their rehab stay. They can see what the therapists are doing with that patient and have a clue how to help that person during the rest of the day when the therapists are not there. Often, too, the therapists will give them some homework, per se, that will allow them to carry on some of the exercises that the patient's doing during the off hours of therapy during the day. For those that are not as closely related to the patient, that won't be involved in the care of the patient after the rehab stay, one of the most important things that friends and family can do is just be connected to the patient and the person that's going to be their caregiver. Caregiver burnout is a very important issue, and just to be supportive and ask, what do you need? I think that's one of the most important things. When family and patient or a friend see a patient on the rehab unit, stop in and talk with the nurse that's caring for the patient. Make sure that if you're bringing anything to the patient, particularly in terms of food or drink, that that person doesn't have any swallowing issues or any problems that you need to be aware of, and if there are any restrictions to the things that you can bring into the patient. But otherwise, just being supportive and being there is one of the most important things that you can do for a person involved in rehab after stroke.
Next up, how modern-day sonography is contributing to the care and treatment of patients today. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. This is Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air, and it's time for your Healthy Monday Minute for the week of May 3rd. Be active for your heart. Aerobic activities like walking, running, swimming, and bicycling make you breathe harder and make your heart beat faster than usual. Over time, regular aerobic activity makes your heart and lungs stronger and able to function better. Incorporate 30-minute intervals of moderate-intensity aerobic activity into your routine this week. See how often you can get your heart pumping. Have a healthy Monday and a healthy week. This is Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Linda Cohen here with you. In this day and age of advances in imaging technology and medicine, there's a job that's becoming increasingly important to the diagnosis and care of patients, and that's the job of the medical sonographer. And here with more on all of this is Lisa Allen. She's the ultrasound coordinator for the Regional Perinatal Center at Upstate Medical University. Welcome, Lisa. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
You know, I don't think a lot of people really understand when we say sonography. Tell us what that is.
Diagnostic medical ultrasound is an imaging technique that uses high-frequency ultrasound waves. We use a transducer, a handheld probe, and the ultrasound waves go into the human tissue and bounce off at different intensities at different times to come back to the transducer and create an image based on the time and the intensity of the signal that is bounced back.
So it's producing a dynamic visual image of organs, tissues, and also the blood flow.
Correct.
In the body, which I think is really interesting. What's so interesting to me also is that this has no radiation or injury attached, potential injury attached to
Correct. It. Yes, well, because it uses sound waves instead of radiation to create the image. However, there are certain limitations that should be used when using ultrasound, and there's a what's called an ALARA principle, which is as low as reasonably achievable. So we are supposed to pay attention to the settings and make sure the intensity is not too high, limit the timing, the amount of the length of the exam to prevent using overexposure. Even though ultrasound is considered safe, it should be used with discretion and not for hours at a time and not for entertainment, but as a diagnostic procedure.
So when you mention diagnostic procedure, help us understand, you know, the kinds of things you're looking, you know, what are you looking at generally? I mean, what different parts of the body is it being used on?
There are several different subspecialties in ultrasound. There's vascular work. When I first started out, I was doing, you know, carotid arteries, looking for stenosis in the carotid arteries to prevent stroke. You can look at the veins of the legs to rule out deep vein thrombosis. There's, you know, ultrasound for pregnancies, kidneys, any organ in the body. And a newer field would be musculoskeletal to look at sports injuries.
Really? So that is it supplanting things like X-ray at this point?
There's obviously a use for all different imaging techniques depending on the area that's of interest. But ultrasound can certainly supersede some of the other imaging things depending on what the diagnosis was going to be.
Now, you yourself are subspecializing in, as someone who's working in the perinatal center, are you working specifically on obstetrics and gynecology then?
Just obstetrics. We're a high-risk OB, so the regional perinatal center actually covers 13 counties in central New York. And we are referral-based, so we get referrals from these 13 counties for high-risk maternal and fetal conditions.
So it seems like there's been, in the last 20 or 30 years, a tremendous increase in the amount of sonography being done in a perinatal center or in a perinatal setting. Is
Absolutely.
That correct? Absolutely,
yes.
And more frequent during the course of a pregnancy.
Yes. Because there's as the research in clinical research continues, there's more applications that they are finding that ultrasound is more useful to diagnose and treat the high-risk pregnancies.
So how exactly does it work? Is it something to do with, as you mentioned, bouncing the sound waves off the tissue?
Correct.
And that sends back some kind of a visual?
Yes, it's kind of, some people, when they ask me about it, like echolocators for when you go fishing,
oh.
In the Doppler, when you see your Doppler maps on, you know, for weather maps, we also use Doppler for blood flow.
Wow, very interesting. So tell me, when you think about this job or this profession, what are the skill sets that you think are of crucial importance? I mean, what are required?
We serve as a clinical rotation site for the diagnostic medical sonography program at Upstate. So every time we have students in, we certainly, you know, you have to have the education, you have to have the experience. You can't learn it from a book because it is a hands-on application. You have to have interaction with patients and good, you know, patient skills, people skills.
So you
skills.
Have to have good people skills.
Communication, yes.
Patience, I would think.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, some degree of patience because you see all variety of patients
right. yes.
with a T. And accuracy, I would think also.
Yes,
I mean,
which comes with experience. Ultimately, the physician reads the film, you know, the ultrasound images and makes the diagnosis, but certainly we know what we're seeing. And generally, a lot of the times, the ultrasonographer is the one that generates the reports. So you have to have, computer skills, and you have to have good grammar. You know, you have to type up the reports. They will correct them and, you know, add or change the report as necessary. But, you know, we also generate, you know, the ultrasound reports.
So it sounds to me like besides being able to deal with patients and have very, very strong technical skills, there's also this notion of you're often the first person or the main person initially to see someone with potentially life-threatening illness of some kind, or in the case of the perinatal center, you're seeing the development of a fetus and a lot of anxiety surrounding that on the part of the patient. How challenging is that? How does that feel?
It can be very uncomfortable, and again, that's something that comes with experience, but generally, whether you're doing, you know, a high-risk pregnancy versus a breast ultrasound or something that they know there's something going on and they're very anxious, generally introduce yourself, you know, let them know that you understand that they're anxious and that this is uncomfortable. They've come from a referring physician and, you know, they don't know you. This is a new place for them. And for us, we have the 13 counties. They're driving. They've gotten lost. They're late for their appointments. And they are very, you know, very upset by the time they get to us. So we just introduce ourselves and let them know, you know, I'm going to be taking the pictures. I know this is really, you know, uncomfortable for you. I can't answer your specific questions. I don't make the diagnosis. The doctor will go over, you know, everything when we're through. You know, and I'm sorry that that's, you know, that's the way that this works.
Because so they're always, yeah. You try to be as reassuring as possible.
Yes, I mean, we try to be compassionate, and you know, everybody's still like, does it look okay? What are you seeing? What are you seeing? Does it look okay?
Of course, I've been in that setting myself.
Gently tell them that that's not the scope of our practice, and we're sorry that that's the way it has to be.
Yeah. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen, along with medical sonographer Lisa Allen. We're talking about what it's like and what it takes to be a medical sonographer. So, what's a typical day like for you in your case doing perinatal?
Generally, we have patients scheduled every 45 minutes. They're a high risk patient. We would start the exam, you know, introduce ourselves and do the exam, and, you know, try to interact with the patient and point out, because it's an exciting time for many of them. They're anxious, but, you know, they're having a baby, and we point out everything, get them pictures, and then generate the report, you know, and certainly just try to make it an enjoyable experience, even with their anxiety, make it as enjoyable as possible.
Yeah, it sounds to me like of all the subspecialties that you enumerated before, that doing this kind of work has got to be more happy than sad,
yes,
in a sense, because for the most part, you really have good information or
yes,
happy information,
yes,
to share, especially when they come out with their little pictures,
mm-hmm, yes,
of a sonogram and say, mm-hmm, here's the new baby. What about the challenges that you find? I mean, are there any challenges that are specific or have developed over the years? Now, you've been doing this for how long?
I've been at Upstate for 23 years, but I've been doing ultrasound for 25.
Wow. You're a real veteran. You don't look like you're a veteran,
well,
but but you're a veteran. So, yeah, tell us about, in your experience, what challenges have emerged over
the challenges years? are, you know, there's an increase in obesity. So challenging patients with obesity. Gastric bypass has been an issue because we have several, you know, patients that have lost a lot of weight and have different challenges in their body types. We have patients that have had prior surgeries, that have, you know, caused limitations to the actual scanning technique.
So that you, in terms of placement or even in terms of mobility of the patient or moving the patient around, requires more strength on your part? What kinds of changes has it
made? Well, we're an outpatient clinic, so our patients are mobile. They generally, you know, can get on and off the table by themselves, but it's just, it requires a lot of strength, arm strength. You know, you're holding the probe on with one hand and running the ultrasound system with the other hand, a lot of twisting and turning and a lot of pressure. The larger the patient, the more pressure that is involved, and it does take its toll on our physical
I'm
bodies,
sure.
But also it's painful for them. If we press harder, it's uncomfortable for the patient, and nobody wants that. And it takes longer to perform an exam on a patient that is, you know, is there's technical limitations to the exam.
So you would say that in the 25 years you've been doing this, that there has been an increase, as you said. Well, there's been an increase in obesity in this country,
yes,
in the last 25 years. So that's really had an impact on your testing, your daily work.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And maybe not so much right now for you in this particular field of perinatal, but in general, it
in
seems
general, yes,
you're seeing that. So how did you decide to become a medical sonographer? I mean, what drew you to this field?
Interesting. It wasn't my first choice. However, I went to Rochester Institute of Technology for undeclared science. So when I had to declare a major, I was given a choice of several different medical choices, and I chose sonography because I just thought it was interesting. And
may I ask what your first choice was?
I actually wanted to go to medical school,
okay,
at one point in time. But they had like nuclear medicine, biomedical engineering, and other choices that just didn't, you know, they didn't fit.
Yeah.
And when I started into the ultrasound program, I just was fascinated by it, and I kind of was still kind of on the medical school track, but then decided that this was probably something that I would enjoy.
Yeah.
So I've stuck with it.
Yeah. So what would you say? What about it is the most gratifying part?
For me personally, because it is operator dependent, you have a lot of autonomy. You are the one. There's a lot of responsibility. Some of the other imaging modalities, you know, you place the patient and run the machine, but you don't have as much patient interaction. I enjoy interacting with the patients, and whether the news is good news or bad news necessarily, I truly feel that I'm doing a service for them. If there is a problem with their babies, that we are able to diagnose it prenatally, therefore they're not going to deliver in one of the rural areas. Things can be done in an organized fashion. They can, you know, have a scheduled delivery and have the appropriate team ready for whatever the, you know, their condition may be.
So you would say that that's the most gratifying part at
this
point.
Yes, I mean, I do. I love my job.
That's wonderful, especially after 25 years. So what would you say to somebody who is considering this as a field? A young person coming up, as you did, who may have thought about medical school or was unsure, unclear, but scientifically oriented.
Right. It is definitely going to boom in the next several years. The ultrasound equipment, the manufacturers are developing more and more technology. It's becoming much more interesting. And as I mentioned, musculoskeletal, working with sports teams and sports injuries tends to be, that is one of the newer fields that's emerging. Ultrasound in, they're using more handheld ultrasound, and like for people that are the countries that are third world countries, and they can use like on their cell phones and send images, telemedicine.
Really? Oh my goodness.
They have handheld ultrasound systems where they might not know what they're doing, but they might be the first responders, ambulance people, you know, people out in military that are out in the field can certainly answer very critical questions very easily and quicker than they have in the past.
So it really is a field on the go,
yes,
on the move.
It's on the move.
And something that sounds like it could be very gratifying.
Yes.
To continue to work. And well, thank you so very much. I appreciate your coming in and sharing all this very interesting information. I don't think most people would have any clue to what a medical sonographer does. So this has been very enlightening. Thanks so much.
My guest
has been Lisa Allen, medical sonographer and the coordinator of the Regional Perinatal Center at Upstate Medical University, coordinator of the sonography and at Upstate Medical University. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. And now, Deirdre Nealon, editor of Upstate Medical University's literary and visual arts journal, The Healing Muse, with this week's selection.
Thank you, Linda. It is widely recognized that art, among its many gifts, is therapeutic for the artist as well as the spectator. In her beautiful personal essay called Piece by Piece, Rachel May illuminates the agony of grief and the healing blessing of time and the power of love. Rachel May is coordinator of sustainability education at Syracuse University. Here is just an excerpt from her essay, Piece by Piece. When we started making quilts, you and I, creative grieving was the farthest thing from our minds. We were excitedly piecing together our disparate lives. We were running appreciative threads to the past through old fabric scraps and traditional quilt block patterns, and hopeful threads to the future for the newborns who might find comfort in our gifts. We were learning how to collaborate, how to take our wild dreams and build them one stitch at a time into something real. And if along the way we also learned how to tie off loose ends and bind up raw edges, well, that was the gift the quilting gave back to us. I taught you how to sew straight lines, how to leave a quarter-inch seam allowance so the raw edges would not show, how to iron the tiny seams open as we went along. I tried to teach you to use the machine, but you loved the feel of needle and thread in your hand, and so we sat companionably and sewed in our laps. Often one of us would read aloud as the other worked. We went through a whole library of Victorian novels this way, enjoying the pathos and plot twists as we snaked our stitches across the quilt tops and reveling in the satisfying conclusions as we sewed up the edges with colorful bindings and passed the finished products along to each new baby in turn. After 4 years and many crib-sized projects, we were ready to make a wedding quilt. Let's get married. What should our quilt look like? Can we wait to decide that, you asked, until I get over this miserable headache? 2 weeks later, the headaches were worse, and a neurologist diagnosed your brain tumor. They operated the next day, my 27th birthday. While you were still under anesthetic, the neurosurgeon announced that you were doing fine, but the tumor looked like medulloblastoma, a rare and aggressive form of cancer. He gave you 5 years to live, but I wasn't to tell you that. My little secret, my birthday present. As soon as you were up and around, we headed to the fabric store. What color should we choose, I asked. Yellow. How about this? I held up a warm sunflower yellow print with brown and orange flowers. This one's nice, too. You pointed out a clear, cool lemon yellow calico dotted with white flowers. So which one do you like best? Both. They had no business together in a quilt, I thought, my New England aesthetic sensibilities in full rebellion. But one reminded you of desert sun on dry hills, and the other of bright chemisa blooming in the arroyos, colors always in your mind, even here, in a gray New England rainfall. And you flatly refused to choose between them. How could I argue with those brown eyes pleading from underneath a bandaged head?
Thanks for joining us for Upstate's HealthLink On Air, brought to you each week by Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, New York. Join us again next week when we explore the state of that ancient disease, tuberculosis. Plus, we'll examine a potential health hazard on the horizon, powdered alcohol, and how walking the walk as a parent can have profound effects on your children. If you'd like to listen again to tonight's show, you can find a podcast of it on our website. That's HealthLinkOnAir, that's all one word, .org. And to keep up with all the goings-on at Upstate, you can find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or check out the What's Up at Upstate blog at upstate.edu/whatsup. HealthLink On Air is directed by Amber Smith and Jennifer Conjol and produced by Steve Marks, with sound engineers John Miller and Gerard Roy. I'm Linda Cohen. Thanks for listening.